Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 108.
We want to unpack what is essentially a masterclass in psychological realism.
Yeah, we're really looking at how people cope with sudden, catastrophic loss and, you know, the masks we wear for our families.
Exactly. And what happens when the ghosts of our past just utterly refuse to stay buried?
It is a profoundly unsettling place to start, honestly. And it perfectly sets the stage for the psychological landscape we are exploring in these sources today.
It really does.
To give a brief lay of the land for you listening, we are focusing on the Gia family. Historically, within the universe of this story, this is an untouchably wealthy, sprawling, aristocratic clan.
Right. They were basically the center of the political and social universe, right?
Exactly. They were it. But right now, at this point in the narrative, they are in a state of steep, terrifying decline. They've suffered massive property seizures.
Just devastating financial blows.
Yeah, and they have fallen entirely out of political favor with the royal court. So the gold is gone, the power is evaporating, and the brutal reality of their new circumstances is really setting in.
The vibe shift captured in the source material is just incredible to me. This is a family that was famous for its lavishness.
Right, lavish doesn't even begin to cover it.
We are talking about a household where money was essentially an abstract concept. There was always so much of it flowing in from imperial stipends and massive land rents. And now...
Now they are literally rationing basic supplies.
Which is wild. The patriarch of the family, Jia Zhang, actually tried to return their massive family properties, including the legendary Grandview Garden, back to the state.
Yeah, he basically went to the authorities and said, look, we can't afford the upkeep, so the state should just take it back.
Which the state rejected, right?
They did. And the mechanism behind that attempted return is fascinating. It really highlights the trap of aristocratic privilege. Well, you couldn't just sell an imperial gift on the open market like a modern piece of real estate. The Grandview Garden was constructed specifically for a royal visitation.
So it's basically a monument.
Exactly. It is a physical monument to the emperor's favor. So when Jia Zhang tries to return it, he is essentially admitting total public defeat.
Oh, wow. I didn't think about the public humiliation aspect of that.
Oh, it's massive. And the state rejected the return. The inner court refused to take the property back, which leaves the Jia family burdened with this massive empty estate that they have absolutely no means of maintaining.
It just becomes a colossal tax and maintenance burden for them.
Precisely. They are trapped by the physical manifestation of their previous glory.
Which means their only real option is to just lock it up. The Grandview Garden, which was once the vibrant beating heart of this family's youth, the place where all the poetry and romance of the novel took place, is now sealed off.
Yes, yeah, just boarded up.
And it's guarded by a single solitary watchman named Bao Yang.
A single man walking the perimeter of an estate that once required hundreds of servants to maintain.
It's eerie.
The spatial emptiness of that is just staggering when you really visualize it.
It is. And it brings us to the very real, very ugly financial strain happening inside the main house, just adjacent to this locked garden.
Right, the day-to-day operations.
The text points out the drastic staff reductions they've had to enact. They've gone from having like 10 servants in some areas down to just 3.
Which is a massive cut in labor.
You can imagine the atmosphere. Mm. The remaining staff, who were entirely used to the generous times where the family basically threw silver at every minor inconvenience, are now grumbling nonstop.
Naturally.
The workload has tripled, the perks are completely gone, and morale is just completely dead.
You see this unfold most vividly when looking at the psychological toll it takes on the management structure of the family. Specifically on Wang Shifeng, who is universally known as Feng Ji.
Right, Feng Ji.
She is the internal manager, essentially the chief operating officer of this massive household. Previously, she was a master manipulator.
A brilliant logistics person.
Exactly. Yeah. A brilliant logistical mind who thrived on managing this huge flow of resources and people. But her genius... Her entire management style, really, was predicated on having an endless cash flow to lubricate the gears of the household.
Right. It's easy to be a great manager when you have unlimited budget.
Exactly.
And now she doesn't.
She is like a brilliant wartime general who suddenly looks around and realizes she has no troops, no ammunition, and the supply lines have been cut.
That is a perfect analogy.
She is struggling to manage the house's operations, basically paralyzed by the lack of resources. Mm. The elders above her aren't happy because their standard of living is dropping.
Right.
The servants below her are complaining and threatening to quit, and she is caught right in the middle of this massive structural collapse, trying to do impossible math.
And we have to remember the physical reality she's operating in, too. You can actually see the physical toll this is taking on Fengji. Yeah, she's really unwell.
She's literally dragging herself out of a sickbed just to keep up appearances for the matriarch, Grandmother Gia. It's the sheer exhaustion of trying to make 3 coins do the work of 10 day after day.
All while surrounded by people who actively resent you for the decline in their comfort.
Exactly. The physical space going to rot is a direct, undeniable mirror of Fengji's own internal depletion.
Wow, yeah.
The locked Grandview Garden isn't just empty real estate sitting next door. It is a powering, inescapable monument to the family's lost golden age. Every single time she looks out the window and sees those locked gates, she is reminded of the impossible task she has been given.
I was thinking about this, and the best way I can relate to the sheer scale of this collapse is to imagine, like, a modern corporate bankruptcy.
Oh, okay. Let's hear it.
Imagine one of those massive tech giants in Silicon Valley. They build this lavish billion-dollar campus with the organic cafeterias, the meditation rooms, the indoor waterfall.
Right. Infinite budget stuff.
Exactly. It's a testament to infinite growth. And then the bottom completely falls out of the market. They have to lay off 70% of their staff overnight.
Yeah, brutal.
They lock up the main campus because they can't even afford the electricity bill to keep the waterfalls running. And the few employees who are left are crammed into a tiny, poorly lit annex building across the street, just trying to pretend the company isn't dying.
That's the Gia family right now. That is exactly the dynamic.
It's so bleak.
The infrastructure of their past glory becomes a haunting presence in their present poverty. But there is a detail in the source material that really complicates this picture of universal suffering within the family.
Oh, I know what you're going to bring up.
Yeah, it has to do with who is actually bearing the brunt of this decay.
That is the part that really got to me.
Mm.
While Fengji is drowning in debt and coughing up blood and Grandmother G is trying to hold the emotional core of the family together, where are the men?
Right, the patriarchs.
The primary male figures of that generation, Gia, Shi, and Jiazhen, are away at their respective government posts in the provinces.
And what are they doing?
They are sending letters home saying, essentially, everything is fine here. We are perfectly comfortable. Don't worry about us. Keep the house in order.
Yeah, just completely detached.
I have to ask, are they genuinely oblivious to the daily misery their family is facing? Or are they just intentionally insulating themselves from it?
Well, to understand the mechanics of that, we really have to look at the gender dynamics and the strict division of labor in this aristocratic society.
Okay, break that down for us.
The men exist in the public sphere, the political sphere. Their reality is dictated by their outward status. As long as they hold a government post, they can maintain a facade of comfort and authority, even if the foundation of their actual home is rotting.
Because they aren't physically looking at the rot.
Exactly. They extract value from the provinces to maintain their lifestyle. The women, however, are trapped in the private sphere.
The domestic side.
Right. They are the ones who actually have to balance the ledgers, deal with the unpaid bills, manage the complaining servants, and live inside the actual physical decay of the household.
So she and Jiazhen have the luxury of physical distance. They don't have to look at the peeling paint or hear the servants whispering in the hallways?
Precisely. Grandmother Gia and Fengji do not have that luxury at all.
Yeah.
The men are sending back these hollow letters of comfort, but those letters offer zero practical help.
None whatsoever.
They ring incredibly hollow against the reality of a locked, overgrown garden and an empty treasury.
It's infuriating. They get to play pretend from hundreds of miles away while the women are rationing the firewood and trying to keep the structure from collapsing on their heads.
This very stark contrast.
So you have this matriarch, Grandmother Gia, sitting in a decaying, understaffed house. The natural human instinct here is to seek external validation, right?
To look outward for hope.
Exactly. To hope someone somewhere in the extended family network is doing okay. And that desperate hope is exactly what makes the arrival of a visitor so devastating.
Oh, absolutely.
Because when you're already at rock bottom, the last thing you need is a comprehensive update on everyone else's misery.
And that is exactly what they get. The visitor who arrives is Shi Shangyun, a beloved childhood friend of the younger generation who is returning to visit after her recent marriage.
Right. And she starts off with good news.
She does. Shangyun begins the conversation by reporting that she is actually doing quite well. Her marriage is peaceful, her husband is kind, and her days are passing quietly.
A rare win.
But the moment she offers this small sliver of good news, the conversation immediately plummets. It turns into a comprehensive inventory of tragedy as Grandmother Gia and the others begin to review the fate of the entire extended family network.
It is a staggering roster of ruin. I was reading this section and marveling at the sheer concentration of grief.
It is relentless.
Let's just walk through what Grandmother Gia and Xiangyin recount in this one sitting, because it's a lot.
Let's do it.
First, obviously, there are the tears shed over the recent death of Lin Daiyu, the brilliant, fragile cousin who passed away under deeply tragic circumstances.
Yes, that trauma is still very fresh and hangs over the entire house.
But then they move on to the living. They discuss Yingchun, who has been married off to a man named Sun Xiaozu, and he is a man explicitly described elsewhere in the novel as a mountain wolf.
Just a deeply cruel person.
Yeah, she is suffering terribly, trapped in a highly abusive marriage with absolutely no recourse to escape.
And the ruin extends far beyond the immediate household, too. The extended network, the allied families they relied on for political and financial stability, they are all collapsing simultaneously.
Like dominoes.
Exactly. They discuss the Zhu family, which is entirely ruined. Xu Pan, the violent and unpredictable son of that family, is in prison and facing execution for murder.
Just a casual murder charge dropped into the catch-up session.
Right. And his wife died under mysterious circumstances. And just recently, a maid confessed to the crime, which barely saved the family from further state retaliation.
And the domino effect of that murder scandal ruins the lives of everyone else in the Su family.
Right.
Zuopan's brother, Su Ke, is delaying his own marriage purely out of conscience because he feels he can't celebrate or start a new life while his brother is sitting in a death row prison cell.
It halts everything.
And another cousin, Baoqin's marriage is also delayed because she is in mourning for her father-in-law. It's like joy has just been universally put on pause for an entire generation of this network.
The isolation only deepens as they continue this conversation. They discuss Tanchun, one of the most capable daughters of the Gia family, who has been married off to a distant, dangerous sea border region to secure a political alliance.
Just sent to the edge of the map.
And the author notes there are absolutely no letters coming back from her. We must understand the geography and communication methods of the era. No news from a dangerous remote border means she is effectively gone forever, swallowed by the distance.
That's terrifying.
And finally, they touch upon the Zen family.
Right, the Zen family. They were basically the Gia family's mirror image, right? Another incredibly wealthy southern aristocratic clan.
Exactly. They were the Gia family's greatest ally and reflection of the society. And they are completely ruined. Their home was raided by imperial guards, their property confiscated, with absolutely no news of their survival.
So Grandmother Gia sits there and listens to all of this. She processes this absolute wave of destruction washing over everything she built, and she uses a phrase that really anchors the despair of this chapter.
Yes, the six relations.
She says, quote, "It is truly a case of six relations sharing the same bad luck." What is the underlying mechanism there? Why the specific phrase six relations?
Well, the six relations is a foundational concept in Chinese philosophy and family structure. It generally refers to the fundamental familial bonds, parents, children, older siblings, younger siblings, spouses, and extended kin.
Basically everyone you are connected to.
Right. Grandmother Gia is acknowledging a terrifying reality about their societal structure. In this era, families do not rise and fall as isolated individuals. They operate as massive, interconnected ecosystems.
Like a modern corporate conglomerate where if the parent company files for bankruptcy, every single subsidiary goes down with it.
That is the exact mechanism. The legal and political structure of the Qing dynasty enforced collective responsibility.
Meaning if one person messes up, everyone pays.
Exactly. If one branch of a family commits a crime like Su Pan's murder or a political misstep at court, the state can, and often did, punish the entire extended network.
Wow.
Grandmother Gia's use of six relations sharing the same bad luck is a profound recognition of collective family karma. They enjoyed the immense wealth, the imperial favor, and the untouchable status collectively.
Right. They all benefited when times were good.
And now, as the wheel of fortune turns, they are enduring the punishment and the rot collectively. When the roots of the tree are poisoned, every single branch dies.
And sitting right in the middle of this realization is Xiangyun.
Poor Xiangyun.
I know. Xiangyun comes in happy. She is the anomaly here. She got the good ending. She is safe. but she realizes almost immediately that her presence and her untainted happiness is making everyone else profoundly uncomfortable.
It's palpable in the text.
The narrative shows us how she feels everyone is treating her differently. They start out wanting to be lively and catch up, but then they just look at her and start crying.
It is a textbook case of survivor's guilt, compounded by the intense social awkwardness of being the only one who escaped the sinking ship.
Yeah, talk about a heavy atmosphere.
Xiang Yan is highly perceptive. She realizes that her happiness is not a comfort to this ruined family. It is a mirror.
That's the tragic irony of it. It's not that Grandmother Jia and the others don't love Xiang Yan. It's that looking at her reminds them of what they all thought their futures were going to look like.
Exactly. She represents the timeline where things worked out.
Every time she smiles or talks about her peaceful home, Grandmother Jia is forced to think of Dayu, who is dead, or Yingchen, who is being tortured by her husband, or Tanxin, who is lost to the sea border. Xiang Yan's happiness is a weapon, and she doesn't even mean to wield it.
You can clearly see the psychological toll this takes on a matriarch like Grandmother Jia. Her entire identity for decades has been the protector, the orchestrator, and the ultimate authority of this massive network of powerful allies.
She was the boss.
She arranged the marriages. She managed the alliances. Now she is sitting in a decaying, drafty house, hearing that every single thread of her elaborate tapestry has unraveled simultaneously.
The psychological weight must be crushing.
It is. The gloom in the room becomes so thick, so utterly suffocating, that Grandmother Jia realizes she has to take drastic action before the family's morale completely flatlines.
She realizes she is losing the room, maybe permanently, so she decides to artificially inject some life into the household.
Forced pivot.
Exactly. And this leads us to what is essentially a mandate of forced fun. Grandmother Jia suddenly remembers, or, you know, perhaps claims to remember to serve her purpose, that it is Bao Chai's birthday in 2 days.
And Bao Chai is a very specific choice.
Right. Bao Chai, being the woman Bao Yu, the golden boy of the family, ended up marrying. Grandmother Jia immediately orders a party. She pulls out 100 silver taels, gives it to her fiercely loyal head maid, Yuan Yang, and says, basically, make it happen. We are going to celebrate.
We really need to translate the stakes of that financial decision for the listener.
Yeah, please do, because 100 taels doesn't mean much to us today.
A single silver tael was enough to feed a commoner family for a significant amount of time. 100 silver taels is a massive, almost reckless sum of money for a bankrupt family to spend on a single evening's entertainment.
It's like maxing out your last credit card to throw a lavish gala while your house is in active foreclosure.
Precisely. This decision to throw a party is completely reactionary. It is not born of actual joy. It is born of sheer desperation.
She's just trying to stop the bleeding.
Grandmother Jia is trying to use money to buy a momentary return to the past, to manufacture the feeling of the golden age. But before the party even begins, she delivers a monologue to the women around her that is incredibly revealing about her current state of mind and how she judges survival.
Okay, this monologue is where I found myself really arguing with the text.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because Grandmother Jia is explaining why they need to celebrate Bao Chai. She heaps praise on Bao Chai, saying she is unflappable, she never complains, and most importantly, she is a person who can endure both wealth and poverty with the exact same calm demeanor.
Right, she calls her an open-minded person.
She praises Bao Chai's stoicism. In Grandmother Jia's eyes, Bao Chai represents the ideal aristocratic woman, perfectly adaptable, emotionally regulated, and entirely unbroken by external circumstances.
That's exactly it.
But Grandmother Jia doesn't stop at praising Bao Chai. She actively uses Bao Chai's stoicism as a weapon to critique the other women who are struggling.
She really does. She uses it as a blunt instrument.
She goes right for the throat. First, she targets Feng Ji, the manager. She criticizes Feng Ji for losing her spark just because times got tough.
Which is incredibly unfair.
It is. She basically says, Feng Ji has seen the world. She shouldn't be so small-minded as to let a little financial ruin change her personality. Which is staggering, considering Feng Ji is the one literally doing the agonizing daily math to keep them all from starving.
It is a profound lack of empathy from the matriarch, shielded by the very labor she is critiquing.
But then she goes after Dayu. She brings up the recently deceased Dayu, and she says, quote, your Lin sister was the most petty and suspicious person, which is ultimately why she did not live long.
That is a brutal assessment.
Are we supposed to believe that? Isn't it incredibly unfair for Grandmother Jia to blame Dayu's death on her pettiness? Dayu wasn't suspicious. She was incredibly observant.
She saw the reality of the house.
Exactly. She saw the walls closing in. She saw the transactional nature of their lives. She saw that her authentic love for Baoyu was being thwarted by the family's political maneuvering, and the helplessness of it destroyed her. To call her petty feels like the ultimate historical gaslighting by the very matriarch who helped engineer the circumstances of her tragedy.
Your reaction is exactly the tension the author intends to provoke here.
Really?
Yes. You are touching on one of the great thematic conflicts of the entire novel.
Yeah.
The battle between authentic, raw emotion, which is represented by Dayu, and practical, socially sanctioned stoicism, represented by Bao Chai.
That makes a lot of sense.
Grandmother Jia's harsh assessment of Dayu in this moment is undeniably unfair. But we have to understand why it is psychologically necessary for Grandmother Jia's own survival to frame it that way.
Wait, let me pause you there. Why is it necessary to tear down the memory of a dead girl just to survive the day? Because she feels guilty.
Guilt is certainly a component, yes. But primarily it is because in a crisis of this magnitude, the family does not need romantics. They need survivors. Grandmother Jia is looking around at the ruins of her empire, and she realizes that Daya's hypersensitivity, her demand for authentic emotional truth, while poetic and beautiful in times of peace and wealth, is absolutely fatal in times of war and poverty.
And the Jia family is in a war for their social and literal survival right now.
Exactly. She praises Bao Chai, because Bao Chai's emotional armor is exactly the mechanism the family needs to get through this. Grandmother Jia is rejecting Dayu's memory because she is terrified of the vulnerability Dayu represents.
That's deep.
If they all allowed themselves to feel the reality of their situation as deeply and truthfully as Dayu did, they would all just completely collapse.
So it's a profound defense mechanism. She has to convince herself that Dayu's way was functionally wrong so she can justify surviving the right way, which is to basically just shut up, endure the pain, and balance the books.
Exactly. Stoicism is a wartime survival tactic, and Grandmother Jia is commanding her troops to adopt it.
Under this mandate of Stoic survival, the invitations for this forced party go out. And the guest list itself plays out like a tragedy.
It really does. Look at Yingshan.
Right. Yingshan attends, but we learn she has been crying for 3 days straight because her abusive husband initially forbade her from going. He told her the Jia family was unlucky and he didn't want their bad luck rubbing off on him.
Notice the transactional nature of his ultimate permission, though.
He doesn't just change his mind out of kindness.
Not at all. He only relents and allows Yingshan to attend when he learns that Jia Zhang, the patriarch, has regained a minor temporary political title.
Unbelievable.
The moment there is a hint of political capital to be extracted from the Jia family, the husband allows Yingshan to go. It highlights Yingshan's tragic position. She is not a beloved daughter returning home for a warm celebration. She's a political pawn being deployed by her abuser to network with her own family.
And then you have Bao Chai, the actual guest of honor, who doesn't even know it's her birthday party.
That is the most surreal part of this.
She gets the invitation, sees all these relatives arriving, and assumes they're just coming over to offer condolences or pity because the family is falling apart. She is so deeply disconnected from the idea of joy that the concept of a birthday party doesn't even cross her mind.
It perfectly illustrates the utter absurdity of the gathering.
Completely absurd.
The family is assembled under this artificial mandate of joy. But as anyone who has ever been commanded to be happy knows, forcing joy in the midst of trauma usually backfires spectacularly.
Yeah, you can't just mandate fun.
The tension in the room is suffocating.
Even Fengji, who is historically the life of the party, tries to crack a few jokes and they just fall totally flat. The narrative shows she couldn't summon her old sharpness to make people laugh.
She's just too exhausted.
The other relatives are only there reluctantly, sitting around thinking the whole thing is completely inappropriate given their financial ruin. They are just lethargic. So to cut through this awful, depressing silence, Grandmother Jia orders a drinking game.
Which becomes the absolute centerpiece of the gathering.
Right.
She calls for her maid, Yuan Yang, to bring out 4 dice to play a highly structured game where the roles dictate lines of poetry and song titles.
Now, I need to admit some confusion here, because parlor games in classic literature are never just games, right? I imagine the author isn't just taking up page space showing us how they pass the time.
Far from it. In classical Chinese literature, drinking games and poetry contests are vital narrative engines.
What do they actually do for the story?
They operate as a mechanism to force characters to inadvertently reveal their subconscious desires, their deepest fears, or their impending destinies.
Oh, wow.
The rules here are simple, but demand immense cultural literacy. You roll the 4 dice, identify the specific classical name of the dice combination, and then recite a line of poetry that matches the theme. If you fail, you drink a penalty cup.
Sounds like high-stakes trivia.
On the surface, it is a game of memory and wit. But in this specific trauma-laden scene, it becomes a game of psychological Russian roulette. The dice are going to unearth exactly what everyone is trying to repress.
A skeleton key for their repressed trauma. So let's look at these rolls because they are incredibly specific. Aunt Sue goes first, and she rolls four ones.
Right.
Yuing Yang, who is acting as the referee, calls this roll the four hoary heads of Mount Shang, which means everyone with some age on them has to drink. What is the historical context of the four hoary heads? Why does that specific phrase matter here?
The four hoary heads refers to four famous, wise elders from the Han Dynasty who fled to the mountains to escape intense political turmoil and live in peaceful obscurity.
Fleeing political ruin.
Exactly. In the context of this forced party, it immediately grounds the game in themes of aging, retreat, and escaping a collapsing dynasty.
That is so pointed.
It's a subtle, deeply uncomfortable reminder that the elders sitting at this table are presiding over a ruined estate, unable to escape their own political turmoil. It sets a melancholic, reflective tone right out of the gate. The universe is already steering the game toward their grim reality.
The mood is heavy immediately. The dice eventually make their way to Bao Yu. Now, Bao Yu is the emotional center of the novel, the golden boy, who is deeply traumatized by everything happening around him. He rolls, and his first roll is a complete failure.
A stink.
Yeah. Yuan Yang calls it a stink, meaning he rolled a dud. He has to drink a penalty cup and roll again. His second roll comes up, and Yuan Yang calls it Zhang Cheng paints eyebrows. And the text specifically points out that this roll makes Bao Shai blush.
Yes, it does.
Why does a phrase about painting eyebrows make his wife blush?
To understand the mechanism of that blush, we need the historical context of Zhang Cheng. He was a highly respected historical official known for one very specific, intimate detail. He would lovingly paint his wife's eyebrows every single morning.
Oh, wow.
Yes. In Chinese literary tradition, Zhang Cheng paints eyebrows is the ultimate, universally recognized symbol of private, romantic devotion and deep marital intimacy between a husband and wife.
Wait, so Bao Yu rules the ultimate symbol of marital romance while sitting right next to the wife he was basically tricked into marrying? That's not just an awkward parlor game. That's the universe actively punishing him.
Exactly. It forces a moment of acute, agonizing awkwardness. It highlights the societal expectation of their marriage that they should be this devoted, deeply intimate couple against the cold reality that their marriage is largely functional. It was born of a trick, and it's permanently overshadowed by Baiyu's lingering, unresolved grief for Dayu.
So the blush is basically her being confronted with what they don't have.
Bao Chai blushes because the role violently forces the entire room to look at their marriage. A marriage she knows and everyone else knows is emotionally hollow.
It's excruciating. But the game continues, and the dice pass to Li Wan. She rolls the dice, and they come up in a red and green split. And Yuan Yang looks at the dice and announces the name of the role, the 12 Beauties of Jinling.
And that is the moment everything breaks.
Hearing the phrase 12 Beauties acts like a skeleton key for Bayou's repressed trauma. It instantly unlocks the vault where he's been hiding his grief, and all of it floods the room at once. He's completely overwhelmed.
It is the psychological trigger of the entire chapter. We really must pause and explain the immense metaphysical and narrative weight of the phrase 12 Beauties of Jinling.
Go ahead. What does it mean in this universe?
Within the universe of the novel, this phrase is not just a clever name for a dice roll. It is the meta-narrative framework of the entire story.
Oh, really?
Yes. In the very fifth chapter of the novel, years prior when they were all young and thriving, Bao Yu had a mystical prophetic dream. In that dream, he was taken to an immortal realm and shown the registers of the 12 beauties of Jinling.
Which are who, exactly?
They are the 12 most important women in his life, including Dayu, Bao Chai, Yingchun, Tanshin, Jiangyan, and others.
Oh, so it was a prophecy of their actual fates?
Yes. In that dream, he was shown cryptic poems and songs predicting their inevitable scattering, their tragedies, and their deaths.
Did he understand it at the time?
No, he didn't understand it then because they were all young and wealthy and together in the Grandview Garden. It was just a confusing dream. But now, years later, sitting at this miserable forced birthday party amidst the ruin of his family, he hears the phrase spoken aloud by the referee.
The narrative describes him looking around the room. He does a literal head count of the women at the table, and the reality of the prophecy crashes down on him.
He connects the dots.
He realizes how many of the 12 beauties are missing from the table. Some are married off to abusive men, some are exiled to the sea borders, and the most important one to him, Dayu, is dead.
It all rushes back to him at once.
The illusion of Grandmother Joya's party evaporates. He is completely overcome with tears. He can't hold it in, so he fakes being hot, says he needs to take off a layer of clothing, and excuses himself from the table just to flee the suffocating room.
The dice literally force Bayou to confront the fragmented reality of his family. The artificial, expensive cheer of Grandmother Gia's 100-tail party just could not withstand the subconscious truth that the game unearthed.
I compare this to, like, a modern family Thanksgiving. Everyone is stressed. The family has had a terrible year. Maybe there was a messy divorce or a recent death in the family.
Right. Everyone is on edge.
But the matriarch says, we are going to play a board game and we are going to have fun. And you're playing charades or Pictionary and someone accidentally draws a card or gives a clue that perfectly describes the person who just passed away.
Oh, that would be terrible.
And in a single second, the entire room's artificial cheer shatters. The silence is deafening, and someone just gets up and walks out of the room because the facade is broken. That is what Bayou just did.
That is a perfect modern parallel. The game drops the illusion entirely. And unable to bear the atmosphere of the party, Bayou flees. But the crucial detail is where he goes.
Right.
He doesn't retreat to his bedroom to sleep it off or hide. He's drawn, almost magnetically, to the very place he's been forbidden to enter.
So Bayou leaves the party. He is wandering, but he is followed by his maid, Shirin. Shirin is a vital character here, I feel like.
She absolutely is.
She is fiercely loyal, very practical, the ultimate pragmatic caretaker, and she tries to stop him from wandering off. But Bayou keeps walking until they reach the locked side gate of the Grandview Garden. And purely by chance, the gate is open because some servants had been sent in to fetch fruit for the party.
It is a fateful opening. The Forbidden Realm, the physical manifestation of their lost youth, is suddenly accessible.
Bayou walks in, and what he sees is a landscape of total heartbreaking decay. This is the place where he spent his golden youth.
His paradise.
Now the flowers are withered. The paint on the beautiful pavilions is peeling off. It is total desolation. But as he looks out over the ruins, he spots something in the distance. He sees a lush, green, thriving grove of bamboo.
And he knows instantly what it is.
Yes, the Xiaxiang Retreat, the former home of Lin Dayu.
The visual contrast the author paints here is brilliant and devastating. You have the man-made structures, the pavilions, the painted wood, the architectural symbols of the Gia family's wealth.
And they are all dead, peeling, and rotting.
Yes. They represent the collapse of the aristocracy, the failure of money. But the bamboo is different. We have to look at the botanical and poetic significance of bamboo in Chinese culture.
Right. What makes bamboo so specific to Dayu? Why does it stand out?
Bamboo is evergreen. It survives the harsh winter. It bends in the wind, but it rarely breaks. It is hollow inside, representing an open, receptive heart, often associated with the scholar, and a pure, unyielding spirit.
Oh, that perfectly describes her.
And also, when the wind blows through a bamboo grove, the rustling leaves sound distinctly like weeping. The bamboo survived the financial ruin of the Gia family because it was never about money. It was a part of nature, mirroring her essence.
So it's like she is still there.
Bayou sees that bamboo, vibrant against the rotting wood of the pavilions, and it acts as a beacon. He knows her memory, her pure spirit is still alive in there.
Jiren sees him looking at the bamboo grove, and she completely panics. She knows exactly what will happen if he goes to Dayu's old house.
She knows his history of breakdowns.
Right. She is terrified of triggering his grief, which has historically caused him to literally lose his mind and fall deathly ill. So Jiren tries to divert him. She actually lies to him.
A drastic measure.
She points in a completely different direction and says, oh no, you're confused. We already passed Dayu's home. That's not it over there. It's getting late. Let's go back.
It is a desperate attempt at spatial manipulation.
She is essentially trying to gaslight him into not being sad. She's saying, look at the map. We passed it. But Bayou's internal compass is locked onto it. He replies that he isn't lost. He ignores her entirely and refuses to turn back.
He'd not be swayed.
I have to say, Shirin is so incredibly relatable here. She is the ultimate anxious friend who is just trying to keep everything from falling apart. She's thinking, please, we just got you stable. Do not walk into the trauma house.
It's very human.
But grief doesn't care about maps, and it certainly doesn't care about logic.
Your framing of Shirin is excellent. She represents the pragmatic demands of the waking world, just as Berchai does. She wants Baoyu to stay safe, healthy, and emotionally flat, because that is what survival requires.
Right. Don't feel too much. Just survive.
But Baoyu, returning to the garden, despite Zirin's desperate warnings, taps into a deeply resonant literary archetype. It is Orpheus descending into the underworld.
Oh, wow.
He knows it is a realm of the dead. He knows it will bring him immense pain to look back at what he has lost. But he is compelled by love, by guilt, and by an overwhelming irrational need to confront the past. He cannot stay in the artificial light of Grandmother Gia's party. He must descend into the shadows of the garden.
So he ignores Yuren's warnings, he steps closer to the retreat, and that is exactly when this psychological trauma crosses the line to something much darker and arguably supernatural.
The turning point of the scene.
As Baoyu nears the bamboo grove, the silence of the abandoned garden is broken. He hears a woman weeping.
He hears crying emanating directly from inside the empty house.
He stops dead. Jiren is right there next to him, and she goes into full denial mode. She insists it's just his memory playing tricks on him. She says, "You used to hear Lin's sister cry here all the time when she was alive. It's just the wind in the bamboo. It's your imagination."
But then the confrontation escalates beyond just the two of them. Other maids, who were deep in the garden fetching the fruit, run up to them in an absolute panic.
They validate what he's hearing.
They warn Baoyu and Jiren to leave immediately. They explicitly state that everyone in the household knows this area is haunted by Dayu's ghost, and that the servants frequently hear her crying at night. Nobody dares to come near the retreat anymore.
So it's not just Baiyu's imagination, the servants hear it too. And hearing this confirmation that Dayu is still there, still weeping, trapped as a ghost in the ruins of her old home, it absolutely breaks Baoyu.
The dam finally bursts.
He completely breaks down weeping, and this is the climax of the scene. He speaks directly to the air, directly to the spirit of Dayu, and he cries out, quote, "Lin sister, it was my parents who made the decision. I did not betray you."
This confession is the absolute crux of Baoyu's trauma. We have to unpack the mechanism behind the phrase, "It was my parents who made the decision."
Let's do it.
In this single cry, Baoyu isolates the core systemic tragedy of his existence and Dayu's death, the total lack of individual agency.
Because to a modern reader, a guy standing in a garden crying, "My parents made me do it," sounds like a pretty weak excuse for breaking a girl's heart.
It does sound like shifting the blame.
But we have to view this through the lens of feudal marriage laws, right? It wasn't a suggestion. It was the law of the universe.
Precisely. In the patriarchal society, marriages among the aristocracy were never about individual love or personal choice. They were highly calculated strategic alliances negotiated entirely by the elders to consolidate wealth and power.
So Baoyu basically had zero say.
None. Baoyu and Dayu grew up together. They loved each other deeply and authentically, but they possessed zero legal or social authority to marry each other. When Grandmother Gia and Baoyu's parents decided that Baochai was a more stable, politically and financially advantageous match for the survival of the clan, Baoyu was literally tricked into marrying her while Dayu lay dying of a broken heart just across the compound.
They executed a literal bait and switch. They told him he was marrying Dayu, and he lifted the veil on his wedding night, and it was Baochai under there.
Exactly. The cruelty of the system is absolute. So Baoyu's cry in the garden, "I did not betray you," is a desperate, agonizing plea for Dayu's spirit to understand that his heart remained true.